Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Well, we are in, Part five, still in chapter two of our study, and somebody are you laughing? All right, then. We ended off verses 14 and 15 last week, so we're going to just circle back there quickly, and then we'll continue on, and this is what we read. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death, and this is referring to Yeshua having to die for us, through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil. And it's just interesting when you see Yeshua in John chapter 12, he says that unless a grain of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it falls to the ground and dies, it produces much grain. And he's referring, this is just a beautiful picture of himself and the reality that if he didn't die, this is what he was saying. He goes, I'd be all alone. I mean, go back and read John 12. He said, I would be alone. And this is the reality, because for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. He'd just be there, and his creation would not be. Unless this grain of wheat falls to the ground, it's necessary to destroy the work of the evil one. Continuing on, verse 15, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. Now, breaking new ground today, verse 16. For indeed, he does not give aid to angels, help. And a lot of the translations use help. He doesn't give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. Now you look at this, the writer is very clear. He's drawing a distinction. Pay attention. He is drawing a distinction between the nature of the relationship of God and the angels and that of God and man, or specifically here, the seed of Abraham. There is a distinction that needs to be met. He is conveying here something so critical. You want to feel the weight of his message in chapter 2, you have to understand this. And just to help you with that, so that we can get the most out of really where he's coming from, and there are certain things that are being said here in between the lines that were just understood by a first century Jew. And so what I want to do is I want to dig into this passage and show you how deep it really goes. And what I want to do first is I really want to identify these terms. I want to identify who these angels are in the context by which the writer is used. He doesn't give aid to angels. Well, I need to tell you, he's actually detailing a specific type of angel. A specific type. And this is what I'm saying. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned. Now look at this. Peter is talking about angels, and he said, for if God did not spare, he did not give aid. He did not give help to who? To specific type of angels, the angels who sinned. All right? But he cast them down to hell and delivered them in chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. So Peter, it's interesting, is saying the same thing the writer of Hebrews says. Let me take it a step further. Take you to Jude. And the angels who did not keep their proper domain, but left their own abode. In other words, their proper domain, their abode was Shemayim. It was heaven. And that's where they should have stayed. He has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. And so Peter's saying the same thing the writer of Hebrews is saying. Jude is saying the same thing that Peter's saying and what the writer of Hebrews is saying. You know what's interesting is this. When Jude made this statement where he's talking about these angels, these fallen angels, the angels who have sinned, do you know what he had in his mind? Do you know what a first century Jew would have in their mind? The book of Enoch. Jude had the book of Enoch in mind when he said this. And all you need to do is continue on in the passage, jumping to verse 14, and this is what we read. Now Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men also saying, now this is interesting, pay attention, because he directly quotes from the book of Enoch, Enoch 1:9. This is the quote, straight out of the book of Enoch. Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment on all, to convict all who are ungodly among them, of all their ungodly deeds, which they have committed in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. And so this is the book that he's drawing from as Jude is talking about these fallen angels. He's drawing from the book of Enoch, and he literally quotes it verbatim. And I will tell you, that's exactly what Peter had in mind. I will tell you, that is exactly what the writer of Hebrews has in mind. This is a reality to a first century Jew, this book that exists that we know, that was read in the first century because it's been found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, I'm taking you on a little bit of a journey here for a reason. And it is a critical reason. If you want to feel the depth and the gravity of the statement that the writer of Hebrews is making in verse 16, simply by saying he did not give aid to angels, I need you to see something specific in the book of Enoch. And so, considering what Jude is talking about here, I'm going to take you to the book of Enoch. And for those of you who are not familiar with the book, it is the backdrop of Genesis 6, where we learn that these angels come down and they have relations with women and they bear children. All right? There is something here that is critical in all of this. And this is what we read. Enoch 12:3, and I, Enoch, or Henoch in Hebrew, was blessing the Lord of majesty and the King of the ages, and lo, the watchers called me, and Enoch the scribe, and said to me, verse 4, Enoch, thou scribe of righteousness, go declare to the watchers of Shemayim, what? Who have left the high heaven. Now, this is interesting because you want to caught it on the first end, but once you know the book of Enoch, once you read it, you realize Jude is actually quoting directly from this passage when he says that the angels who did not keep their proper domain, but they left their own abode, he's drawing from this passage right here. And so, who have left the high heaven, the holy eternal place, and have defiled themselves with women, and have done as the children of earth do, and have taken unto themselves wives, and yea, have wrought great destruction on the earth. Now, this is an amazing thing. They took for themselves wives, and out of you have angelic beings from heaven coming down and having relations with women, taking the wives. They produced offspring. That's what happened. They produced offspring. And that's why they did it, because they wanted families. As we go into the verse 5, listen, and ye shall have no peace nor forgiveness of sin. Think about that statement. There's no forgiveness of sin for you. And inasmuch as they delight themselves in their children, the murder of their beloved ones shall they see. And over the destruction of their children shall they lament, and shall make supplication unto eternity, but mercy and peace shall ye not attain. Now this is an amazing passage, and I want to show, just let me bring you back to Jeremiah 52. I'm not going to put it up on the screen. But one thing you got to understand about Jeremiah 52, what do we read about? We read about Zedekiah. He rebels against the king of Babylon. What happens to him? The last thing he sees with his eyes is his children being killed before him, and then he pluck out his eyes. That is exactly what is prophesied of these angels. In other words, what I'm telling you is Zedekiah, that whole story, is deeply prophetic. It's deeply prophetic, and you need to feel it. You need to feel what these angels, what has been prophesied over these angels of what's going to happen. You wanted families? You wanted to have offspring like the men of the earth, and you went and did this? The last thing you're going to see is them destroyed before your face. You know the pain and the suffering that is coming in judgment? We need to feel that weight. Now, continuing on, verse 13, verse 1, and Enoch went and said, Azazel, thou shalt have no peace. A severe sentence has gone forth against thee to put thee in bonds, and thou shalt have no toleration nor request granted to thee because of the unrighteousness which thou hast taught. And because of all the works of godlessness and unrighteousness and sin, which thou hast shown to men, verse 3, then I went and spoke to them all together, and they were all afraid. So you have Enoch talking to the angels, and they were all afraid. Fear and trembling seized them, and they besought me to draw up a petition for them that they might find forgiveness and to read their petition in the presence of the Lord of heaven. The moment Enoch comes to them and tells them, you have no hope. These angelic beings that are greater in power than might than we are, what happened to them? They melted. They had no strength. They're terrified. Now, you think about this. Angels of God in heaven terrified over this concept that there wouldn't be forgiveness. So you know what? They talk to Enoch. They drop this petition. They want him to present this, to read this. Okay, moving on to verse 5. For from thenceforward, they could not speak nor lift up their eyes to heaven for shame of their sins for which they had been condemned. Verse 6. Then I wrote out their petition and the prayer in regard to their spirits and their deeds individually in regard to the request that they should have forgiveness and length of days. And I went off and sat down at the waters of Don in the land of Don to the south of the west of Hermon. I read their petition till I fell asleep. So here you have Enoch. The angels have convinced him, go, take this petition. We cannot bear this. We are so ashamed. We're terrified. We need hope. Enoch takes that petition. He presents it to the Lord. And this is where it continues. And behold, a dream came to me, and visions fell down upon me, and I saw visions of chastisement, and a voice came bidding me to literally tell it to the sons of heaven and reprimand them. So the Lord Enoch takes the petition to the Lord. The Lord responds with an answer. He gives them an answer to Enoch, and he says, now go take it to the watchers. Go take it to them. So now as we come to chapter 14, verse 4, just jumping ahead a little bit, Enoch tells the angels this, I wrote out your petition, and in my vision it appeared thus that your petition will not be granted unto you throughout all the days of eternity, and that judgment has finally been passed on you. Yea, your petition will not be granted to you. They were begging for mercy. God, have mercy. Please have mercy on us. Who else are they going to turn to? This is the God of heaven and earth, and they are completely rejected. So here's the thing. When we read this, for indeed, he does not give aid to angels. Feel the weight of that. Understand that they begged for mercy. And then he goes on, and yet he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. He gives aid. He gives hope. However, after defining the term angels and knowing that we're dealing with a specific type of angel, that the writer of Hebrews is referencing, it is only fair to go onto the other side of the tracks. You have to define who the seed of Abraham is, because that's the only one that is given aid. Who are the seed of Abraham? Well, let's take a peek here. I want to take you to John chapter 8, verse 38. This is Yeshua speaking. He says, I speak what I have seen with my Father, and you do what you have seen with your father. Now, his audience is Jewish. He's speaking to his Jewish beloved brethren. And all of a sudden, he tells them that he has a different father. He makes a distinction. Okay? I have one father. You have another father. Well, how do they respond to this statement? Well, as you go on, verse 39, then the Jews answered and said to Yeshua, Abraham is our father. Okay, so this response is important. Okay, you have to understand, them coming back and saying, declaring Abraham is their father, what they're saying is, listen, we are the legitimate heirs of the covenant. We are children of promise. We are children of hope. We have a future. The inheritance that was promised to our father Abraham, it is our inheritance. In other words, they're declaring, we have an identity. We know who we are. We are children of God. See, because that is the most critical component to the covenant given with to Abraham. Just go back and read Genesis 17, and what you will see, the most important part of it is, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. It's the most important part of the whole covenant, and this is what they're declaring. We are the children of God. How does Yeshua respond to that? Yeshua said to them, if you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham. What a scary response. Because Yeshua challenged them, said, you are not the children of Abraham. And yet in the same chapter, and I didn't show it to you, but in the same chapter, he acknowledges that they are physical descendants of Abraham. Or what you would call the seed, the Zerah or Zeraim, the seed of Abraham. He knows that. See, but biblically defining is spiritually defining this term, there's a little more to it. The Apostle Paul in Romans 9, verse 6 says, but it is not that the word of God has taken no effect, for they are not all Israel who are of Israel, nor are they all children because they are the seed of Abraham. There's that term that the writer of Hebrews is using. The seed of Abraham. But in Yitzhak, Isaac, your seed shall be called. That is those who are children of the flesh. These are not children of God, but the children of promise are counted as the seed. Talk about an amazing way to define this term that the writer of Hebrews is using. Absolutely critical. It's not talking explicitly in regard to physical descendants. No, no, no. What we're talking about is Galatians 3:7. Therefore, know only those who are of faith are sons of Abraham. Faith, you must believe. Jumping to verse 29. And if you are Messiah's, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. You have to confess them. So when we see this passage in Hebrews 2:16, he only gives aid to the seed of Abraham. You better understand what that means. It's only those who confess Yeshua as the Messiah. They dedicate their lives, they commit their lives to following him. They will become the seed. Jew to the Jew first, and also to the Gentile. Now, this should make sense, because what we've been talking about the last couple weeks is, what's the whole point the writer is trying to convey here? You cannot neglect so great a salvation. His whole point, the writer of Hebrews, is you need Yeshua. Well, he's talking to the physical descendants. So clearly, the writer of Hebrews is using this term, seed of Abraham, in the exact context that we see it being used throughout Scripture, throughout the New Testament. It is in the context only that you need Yeshua. You must have him, and then you can become the seed of Abraham. That's where the forgiveness is. Forgiveness which the angels of God in heaven do not have. Moving on to verse 17, we read this. Therefore, in all things, he, meaning Yeshua, had to be made like his brethren. And I want to point this out. Let me highlight this. But this made like, homoiao in the Greek. Homoiao. It literally means to make like, but to assimilate. Now, why am I drawing attention to this? Because one of the things that I'm making sure to convey in this teaching is that Yeshua was not simply made, okay? And when conceived, when Mary had conceived him in her womb, he didn't just exist at that point, which there are several people, believers, that will go out and tell you he didn't eternally pre-exist. Well, I point this out when you look at this and what the writer is conveying, it's very clear. He did eternally. How can I assimilate? How can anyone assimilate to something else if they didn't previously already exist in a specific state? It's impossible. And this is the point, okay? He assimilated. Something is happening here. See, the word is becoming flesh. There's an assimilation to what? To man, to flesh and bone. He's assimilating. Apostle Paul says the same thing in Philippians 2:5. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Messiah Yeshua, who being in the form of God, he was in the form of God, glorified. You can read John chapter 17. This glory that he had with the Father, he already had it. He was in the form of God. He did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself. He made himself of no reputation. And what did he do? Taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. He completely humbles himself. He empties, you look at this in the Greek, he empties himself. And he takes this form of a bondservant. And so he was in the form of God, but now he's in the form of this flesh and blood. All right, so this is the concept that we're seeing here being conveyed, that he had to be made like his brethren. But then we get to the question, why? Why did Yeshua assimilate? Why come in the flesh? Why not snap your God? Snap your fingers and say, you know what? You're all forgiven. We're good. You're just all forgiven. Well, he goes on to express why. That he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. Now, obviously, first and foremost, the purpose of Yeshua coming in the flesh, it's to atone for sins. But understand something. It's not just it. That's not all there is to it, all right? There's more. It's that he would come, that he might come to be a merciful and faithful high priest. What does that mean? I mean, what does that mean? Well, fortunately, the writer goes on to tell us in verse 18, for in that he himself has suffered being tempted, he is able to aid those who are tempted. Think about that statement. He was tempted as we have been tempted. I mean, he can empathize with us. That dramatically changes everything in regard to relationship. Dramatically changes everything in regard to it. Hebrews 4:15, let's just jump ahead real quick. For we do not have a Kohen Gadol, a high priest, who cannot sympathize. Now, I want to say this, because this is a unique situation. The NIV actually translates it better than pretty much all the other translations. And that's not normal. But in this instance, it does. What you'll find, here you have the New King James that says sympathize. Many of the other translations have sympathize. And sympatheo is the Greek. And so they say sympathize, but I want to be very, very clear. The NIV has it way better. They say empathize. There is a significant difference. I can sympathize with your issues. And I can say, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for the way you feel. You know, I'll go pray for you. And I can have true conviction about it. And I can have integrity and mean it. That's sympathy. That's great. Empathy says, I've been there. I've experienced. I know what you're going through. And isn't it interesting that when you have all these support groups or the people that need help, they want other people that have been through what they're going through or going through it at the time, at least. It's very different. This is what's being conveyed. Not sympathy, empathy. So we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize or empathize with our weaknesses. Why? Because was in all points tempted as we are, and yet without sin. In other words, the fight that we fight in this flesh against demonic powers that we cannot see in this realm that are constantly bombarding us, that are coming to us, all the tribulation and the trials that we experience, guess what? He dealt with it all. He dealt with it all. In the flesh, he dealt with it. I mean, wrap your mind around that. He had to do this so he knew what we had experienced so that he could be merciful to us. Powerful, powerful thought. We're not dealing with someone that doesn't understand us. You know, for me, and I know the truth is for you, that can be a comforting thought. It can be comforting to know. I mean, it will change your prayer life. It should change your prayer life. It should change your aspect of understanding how this relationship works, because we don't serve a God that doesn't want relationship. We serve a God that wants to hear us, that wants us to go to prayer, that is yearning for us to go to his word so that we can hear him. This beautiful relationship where we read his word, he speaks to us, and we go to prayer and speak to him. And this whole process of praying, of reading the word, completely changes when in my mind, I have the enemy telling me he doesn't care. He has no concept of where you're coming from. All of these things where I can go and I know my Messiah face everything I did and more. So no matter what I'm going through, I know he went through worse. And that is going to bring me to the throne humbly. I am humbled the fact that he went through what I have, but way worse than I have. Keeps me on track. And this is what this writer of Hebrews is conveying. It's incredibly important to understand this. Let me jump ahead again into chapter 5, verse 1. For every high priest, and for those of you, if you don't know, if you're newer to the faith, and you what's this high priest? The point of the high priest was to intercede on behalf of the people, to make atonement for them before God, to keep them in good relationship to God. This is who Jesus, who Yeshua is. He keeps us in relationship. So for every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men in things pertaining to God that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray since he himself is also subject to weakness. It makes perfect sense. Verse 8, though he was a son, meaning Yeshua, yet he learned obedience by the things he suffered. He learned obedience. You know, I want to be clear on this. This does not mean in a context of how my children learn obedience when my wife and I, when we correct them. They need to learn obedience. We have to correct them because they were doing wrong. That's not what this is saying. When it says he learned obedience, what it means that he learned obedience, he experienced, he learned what it meant to obey God perfectly while being tempted on every side. By going through trials and testing while experiencing fear. All of these things Yeshua experienced, but he overcame. He was without sin. That is an amazing thing when you think about it. Absolutely amazing. He had to experience what we did. And this was prophecy. I want to take you back to Isaiah 7. So powerful. You won't read it the same again. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son. So we have a son being born to what? Flesh and blood. He's assimilating. He's coming in. We bear a son, and you shall call his name, but this is interesting, Emmanuel, meaning God with us. That's what it means. It means God is with us. Finally, God is with us. But he's in it. He's with us in this tent, in this fleshly tent, right? Now listen to this. Curds and honey he shall eat. Why? That he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. Now, for those of you, when you look at this, what does it mean? Why does it say he had to eat curds and honey? What is that a reference to? If you actually look at Isaiah 7 in a broad spectrum, what you realize is it talks about a time of vulnerability, a time where you're going to experience difficulty, a time of deprivation. He will eat curds and honey. He will do this. That he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. He knows what that means. He had to experience it. Because think about God. Prior to Yeshua, the word becoming flesh, he couldn't possibly relate. He's God. He doesn't face any temptation for evil. He's holy. He's pure holiness. And yet, he knew that that had to happen. Why? Because he wants relationship. He wants the most intimate relationship that you could possibly desire, to have better than a best friend, one who is closer than a brother. Man, that is an awesome thing. This is an awesome thing that the writer of Hebrews is laying out for us. So as we look at you know, verse 18, for he himself suffered being tempted, this is what we're dealing with. But that's not it. That's not it. Look at the last part here. Let me highlight it. He is able to aid those who are tempted. So it's not just about him experiencing this. There's more to this relationship. There's more to this benefit of calling and following as a disciple the Messiah Yeshua. He's going to rescue you. There's aid. There's help, right? And I think of Psalm 50, one of my favorite verses, right? Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you. And you shall glorify me. I mean, that's a promise. That is, you call upon the name of Yeshua, you will be delivered. He will help. There is absolute help. Whatever you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive. If you ask anything in my name, that you will receive. You will receive it. If you ask in a name, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. Now, moving on. into chapter 3. Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider, meaning step back, because all these truths we've been talking about, chapter 1 and chapter 2, everything we were just discussing, you need to step back and you need to perceive it carefully. What? What do we consider? The apostle and high priest of our confession, the Messiah, Yeshua. In other words, with each passing verse and of the writer of Hebrews and the testimony he's given, scripture after scripture, consider the Messiah Yeshua, the high priest. Verse 2. Who was faithful to him, meaning to the Father, who appointed him. Who was faithful to him who appointed him, but look at what he says now. As Moses also was faithful in all his house. Now, I want to be very clear. This is not a coincidence that he didn't just arbitrarily, I'm just going to go quickly grab some righteous men, and there were many righteous men in the Old Testament. I'll go grab one of them, and we'll bring it to the service, and we'll just liken it to Yeshua. I mean, there are many, many righteous men he could have did that, but he's very specific here to grab Moshe. He grabs Moshe intentionally. Why does he do this? He's expressing a very important concept here. And that is, he's declaring to his Jewish brethren someone that they were waiting for, the prophet like unto Moses. This is who they're waiting for. And when you know how great this one is, you'll understand why. This prophet like unto Moses that they were supposed to wait for that would deliver them. Okay? Let me take you to the prophecy itself in Deuteronomy 18. And this is the Lord speaking to Moses. Okay, he says, I will raise up for them a prophet like you. So here's the prophet. I'll raise up a prophet like you from among their brethren, meaning he's going to be Jewish, he's going to be of Israel. And I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall be that whoever will not hear my words, which he speaks in my name, I will require it of him. So three things, really. He's going to raise up a prophet like Moses. So look at understand Moses' life. Do you know who he is? Because I'm going to raise up a prophet like him from among their brethren. Number two, I'm going to put my words in his mouth. And number three, you don't listen to him, you're dead. You are a dead man. And so there's a lot of fear that goes with this passage. There's a lot of fear and trembling that comes with this prophet like unto Moshe. This fascinating statement Yeshua makes as he gets to John chapter 12. See if it sounds familiar. He who rejects me and does not receive my words has that which judges him. The word that I have spoken will judge him in the last day. For I have not spoken on my own authority, but the Father who sent me gave me a command what I should say and what I should speak. What do you suppose Yeshua is talking about? He's declaring that he is the prophet like unto Moses. He's declaring, the Father has put his word in my mouth. I'm declaring it to you. If you do not heed it, you will be judged in the last day. You will be destroyed. Literally, exactly what the prophecy said in Deuteronomy 18, he's coming forth and telling him, I'm that prophet. I'm the guy you've been looking for. You know, you look at this life of Moshe and you compare it to that of Yeshua, and I'm telling you, it's uncanny. It's crazy. It's not just a bunch of, oh, this is a really amazing coincidence that Moses did this, and Moses said this, and Yeshua did this and said this. There are things that are recorded about Moses that are so ridiculous, bizarre, weird details of his life that are fully realized in Yeshua. I want to give you a few examples. And the first thing I want you to note is Moses wasn't just a Navi, which is to say a prophet. He wasn't just a prophet. He was more than that. He was a priest. And when you think about it, most people don't think of Moses as a priest. Well, he performed priestly functions. In fact, the most critical high priestly functions you could imagine. In other words, it was Moses, not Aaron, it was Moses who went and anointed the tabernacle. It was Moses who made atonement for the altar. It was Moses that sacrificed and killed the animals at the consecration for the high priest, Aaron, for the Kohanim, for his sons. He consecrated them. He shed the blood. He did all things that only a priest can do. Nobody but a Kohen could approach the altar. And yet these are all things that Moses did. So here you have Moses. He is a prophet. Here you have Moses clearly performing high priestly functions. And he was a judge. Moses was the judge. And I say the judge. He was the Supreme Court in Israel. There was lower courts. There were other judges that were set up through the guidance of the Lord ultimately, but through Yitro, his father-in-law. He set up lower courts, but he was the judge. He had the final say. What is Yeshua? He is the judge. He will have the final say. Let me take it a step further. There's something really peculiar said about Moses. It's said once. It's almost obscure, if you will. And for Jews, it's a little enigmatic, if you will. But in Deuteronomy 33, verse 4, we read this. In fact, even some people try to translate it differently. Moshe commanded a law for us, a heritage of the congregation of Jacob, and he was a melech in Yeshurun. Okay? He was a king. Yeshurun is, that's another statement for Israel. Simply means upright one. Okay? He was a king. So you have Moses as a prophet, a priest, a judge, and a king. All of these things describe the Messiah, Yeshua. Interesting, he really is the prophet like unto Moses. Let me take this a step further, though. You want to talk about being crazy and hearing crazy things? So the Lord said to Moshe, "See, I have made you as God to Pharaoh." And the word there is Elohim. And some people might say, "Well, Daniel, you know what? Elohim is used for judges. You can read Exodus 21, Exodus 20. That can be a term just used. And this is kind of what it's just saying in regard to Moses, that he shall be as God to Pharaoh. Really? How many of those judges would you say have their own prophets? See, only God has his own prophets. And Aaron, your brother, shall be your prophet. The context is obscure. Now, no, do we believe Moses is God? No, we're not saying that. No Jew would tell you that. Nobody. But isn't it interesting that this is in the passage? You shall be as God to Pharaoh. So here when Yeshua comes on the scene, declaring himself to be God because he's the Son of God, I mean, there is a precedent. According to the prophet that was to rise up to be like Moses. That is an amazing. And let me take this a step further. Did Yeshua have a prophet that stood with him? Like Moses? Can you say John the Baptist? Oh yeah, what was John? He was a son of Aaron. He was a Kohen. John the Baptist was a Kohen, and he went out as Yeshua's prophet, just as Aaron went out as Moses' prophet. You cannot make this stuff up. This is what I'm talking about. It's so ridiculous. All these little things. Let's go further. Moses fasted for 40 days. Sound familiar? Yeshua fasted for 40 days. But it is interesting when you see the context of Moshe fasting for 40 days because he went up to get the law, the Torah, and upon that expiration, he came down after fasting and brought the ministry with him, the ministry of God. Yeshua fasted for 40 days in the wilderness, and what happened? He came out of the wilderness and said, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." And that's exactly what happened to Moses. This is exactly what happened to Moses. Moses was considered a deliverer. Yeshua is no question a deliverer. I mean, the mission of Moses was to go to the children of Israel, okay? He wasn't in the land of Egypt. He fled the land of Egypt. God sent him back, go back and deliver my people. The very mission of Yeshua was to come and deliver the children of Israel. It's the same image. I mean, this is the prophet like unto Moses. Moses was substantiated upon all the miracles and signs that God gave him. When Moses was concerned, well, they're not going to believe me. What did the Lord do? He set up miracles. He set up signs to show that this is you. It's interesting, as you go to John chapter 5, Yeshua says, "I have a greater witness than John, for the works that I do, the works which the Father gave me to do, they bear witness of me that I'm from God." Unbelievable. It's uncanny. Exodus 2:13. "And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting." This is Moses, okay? And Moses said to the one who did the wrong, this is important, he goes to the one who did the wrong, why are you striking your companion? Then he said, who made you prince or judge over us? Isn't that interesting? See, the ones that were not doing right, that were not walking a relationship with God, they looked at Moses, this deliverer, and they say, who made you prince or judge over us? That's interesting, because when you go to Acts chapter 7, and you look at Stephen talking to these rebellious Jewish people, what does he say? He quotes this verse in regard to Yeshua. He's saying, look at this. This is who you are. You're rejecting him. Who made you prince or judge over us? They rejected when Yeshua came to a generation that rejected him. And that was according to Bible prophecy. But this is the reality. The stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. So here you have another example of Yeshua literally being a prophet like unto Moses. Moving to Exodus chapter 5, verse 21. And they said to them, this is Moses and Aaron, okay, they're going, let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent, you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. Now think about that. So Moses comes on the scene, and the response of his ministry is, you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and his people. In other words, Pharaoh is representative. Egypt was representative of the then known world. You've made us abhorrent in the world. Now, I ask you, and you could just read, let's say, John 15. And he says, if the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hated you. For if you were of the world would love its own. But because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. In other words, what I'm saying is the very response. They're saying that because Moses comes on the scene, he comes to deliver the people, now they're abhorrent to the world. That is the exact response that happened with Yeshua. When he came into his ministry, when he accomplished his ministry, we've now been made abhorrent to the world. Absolutely. Going back to Exodus 2:16. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters. So Moses, when he fled Egypt, he has a situation. And they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs with water from their father's flock. Now look at this. This guy is recorded, he has seven daughters. These daughters are drawing water, right, to feed the father's flock, okay? Then the shepherds, now we got shepherds involved. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moshe stood up and helped them and watered the flock. Now, again, you cannot make this up. Go to Revelation, and how many churches are mentioned? Seven. It's interesting. And the whole concept of this drawing water, they're drawing living water. This is his word to feed their father's flock. In other words, the point of these seven churches is to feed the flock. Now, what do you read in Revelation? In all these churches, what do you read with these churches? Shepherds had come in and they were perverting the word. They were perverting the flock. I'm telling you, you can't make this stuff up. This is so incredible. And that's why you have this saying from the rabbis, the Maaseh Avot Siman Lebanim. The deeds of the fathers are a sign for the children. In other words, all these things that happened in Scripture that we read about the fathers, such as Moses, they're going to happen again. They're prophetic of something much, much more profound. And this is just a reality. You can't make this up. So Moses stood up to protect them. And Yeshua, go read Revelation. Yeshua comes in and rebukes these churches, most of the churches. He comes and rebukes them to set them straight. Unbelievable. And to protect them. Numbers 11. And we're just scratching the surface. And Moshe said to the Lord, why have you afflicted your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight? I want you to look at that. Why have you afflicted your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight? Does the term Eli, Eli, Lama, Azavtani sound familiar? You may have read it in Matthew 27. My God, why have you forsaken me? This is Yeshua's cry as he's sitting on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? And isn't this interesting? You'll notice Yeshua is called the servant of the Lord in the New Testament. And here we see you have afflicted your servant. Why have I not found favor in your sight? What are you doing to me? That you have laid the burden of all these people on me. You've laid the burden of all these people on me. That sounds familiar. Isaiah 53, 6, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. I mean, every corner that you turn and you start analyzing the life of Moses, all you see is Yeshua, the prophet like unto Moses. This one I love. Exodus 4, 24, and it came to pass on the way at the encampment that the Lord met Moses and sought to kill him. The person being spoken of here is Moses. And it's always interesting to read Orthodox commentaries on this because it's an enigma. They don't know what to do with this. They don't know how to answer. I've even read commentary like, well, I think we're missing some stuff in the Masoretic text that maybe we'll find sometime later. We'll find housed where it extrapolates something to fill in gaps because there's gaps here. But here you literally have the Lord comes to meet Moses to kill him, all right? What is the point? When you see Yeshua came, why did he come? Because the Lord desired to kill him. He desired to kill him so that we could have life, to save civilization. This is a reality. Now let me continue on. Then Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at Moses' feet and said, surely you are a husband of blood to me. So he let him go. Then she said, you are a husband of blood because of the circumcision. Here, the Lord wants to come and kill Moshe, and then his wife declares to him, you're a husband of blood to me. Profound. Yeshua is our husband of blood. He is a husband to us because of the blood. We are redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. And then, of course, we could talk about the fact that Moses died. Right? Go to the end of the Torah. So which I think we're at the end of the Torah now because we're at the end of the Torah cycle. I'm sure you may have read it. Moses died. He went to Mount Nebo, and the people are wailing in the plains of Moab. He died there. What else do we know about Moses? He was resurrected. He was resurrected. And you can't make this up either. Let me take you to Jude 1:9. Yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, the Lord rebuke you. I ask you, why was Michael contending about the body of Moses? See, all you need to do is read Matthew 24. See, because when the trumpet blows, at the last trump, and the Lord commands his angels, he's going to send his angels to go out to the four corners of the earth to go get the saints. The angels are going to pour out of heaven, and they are personally escorting us into heaven. Isn't this interesting? Why do you think Michael was there? Because he was raising him from the dead. He was bringing him into the kingdom of God. And there's further New Testament support of this. Okay, so you go to Matthew 17. And what do you see in Matthew 17? Yeshua goes up. Peter, James, and John are looking at the Mount of Transfiguration. And who do they see? Moses and Elijah talking with him. Now, Elijah never died. He never died. But there Moses is because he was resurrected. Yeshua is the prophet like unto Moses. There's no debate. And we could go on and on and on. But when we look at this, and we look at the writer, this little statement, as Moses was faithful in all his, he's bringing this to the surface because he's telling them, I'm telling you who Yeshua is. He is blowing their minds with the fact that he started in chapter 1, Yeshua is God. Now in chapter 2 and in chapter 3, now he's the high priest. And then he starts talking about, well, he's the prophet like unto Moses. I mean, this is a book of all books.